and comes in only certain circumstances. The second category are cases where a state's attorney might have a conflict. There are some circumstances where in some smaller counties or even some larger counties where the public defender will be elected state's attorney. And at that point, whomever the public defender had been representing is conflicted out and conflicts out the entire state's attorney's office. And in those instances, the attorney general steps in. The third category are cases where the state's attorney needs some help, some trial assistance. It could be a very small county, could be a very large case, and the attorney general has a trial assistance team.
Anatomy of a murder is the classic example.
Excuse me?
Anatomy of a murder is a classic example.
Yes, yes. And there are capital cases across the state.
Oh, yes, but, yes, yes. The former First Lady of Illinois was one of those who prosecuted those across the state.
And so does this kind of case fall into those three categories? And the answer is no. It's noteworthy that the only state's attorney the plaintiff sued was the state's attorney of Cook County. Now, so why name the attorney general? Certainly not because there's any real prospect, any non-fantastical prospect, that under Illinois law, which makes the state's attorneys the primary enforcers of criminal statutes, that the attorney general would ever be the state official to bring a prosecution like that in Cook County, which has 900 lawyers of its own, at more than double.
That's 101 to go.
100, and that leads to the second question,
Pride,
which is why name the attorney general rather than the other state's attorneys? And the only explanation, and Mr. Smith may shed some light on this if he has time when he comes up here, is that the plaintiffs want to bind the state as a whole and use the expedient of naming the attorney general in order to bind the state as a whole rather than bringing suit against the people who are charged by Illinois law with actually enforcing that statute.
If a person was arrested, charged, and fined under the statute and then challenged the statute on First Amendment grounds, at what point, if any, would the AG's office become involved in defending the constitutionality of the statute?
Certainly at the Illinois Supreme Court level, where the Attorney General has the exclusive authority to represent the state. It's conceivable that the Attorney General could get involved in the trial court or the appellate court, but that never, in my experience, happens because at the trial court level, the state's attorney handles the constitutional challenge. And at the intermediate appellate court level, either the state's attorney in Cook County or the state's attorney appellate prosecutor in the other four districts of the state defend the statute.
As I sit here, I can't remember the main case that you relied on, but I do remember that it was not, that it did not involve a criminal statute.
That's correct.
And so it cannot be determinative.
No, it's not determinative.
Okay.
It is not. But it certainly indicates that it would be it does have language saying two things. One is, and I see I'm out of time, Judge Rover.
Go,
may I conclude?
Go, of course.
One thing is, the first thing that it says is that under Illinois law, state's attorneys are the public prosecutors. And the second thing it says is that it's improper to name the attorney general simply in an effort to get a judgment that binds the state as a whole.
Mr. Feinerman, we asked you a lot of questions, and you've run out of time, but I'm going to give you an extra minute or so you can have
thank
the
you, Judge
rebuttal time you asked for.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Paul Smith for the Appellees. And as the court has noted, I think already, we say the basic constitutional problem with the sexually explicit video game law is that the law does not require a showing of compliance with all three of the Miller-Ginsburg prongs, in that it omits one, the serious value prong.
So if the statute added if they go back to the legislature and the statute adds the third prong of Ginsburg-Miller, what objections, would remain to the sale provisions?
Your Honor, such a law already exists. They, in the very same bill that passed this law, they added an explicit reference to video game laws, video games, to the harmful to minors statute. So there is no need for a law to cover harmful to minors video games if such exist. The only apparent purpose of this law was to go after video games with sexually explicit material but serious value for minors. And the state has never... one of the problems with this case is the state has never tried to articulate any reason to think that's a problem. What games they're thinking about, what games the legislature was worried about, are there such games? You came up with a hypothetical, Judge Rovner, which is the kind of thing they must have been thinking about, something educational but sexually explicit and prurient, but there's no indication of any reason why the existing harmful to minors standard, which has been the standard applied to books and magazines and videos and movies for the last 33 years, couldn't just as well apply to video games, that there's something distinctive about these video games that led the legislature to try to pass a much broader proscription on sale to minors.
In your brief, you didn't really respond to the argument that, excuse me, in the second prompt, of the Ginsburg test, the mm-hmm. phrase as a whole applies to the community and not to the material. But, you know, would you respond to that now?
Sure.
I mean, are you conceding?
No,
that
Your
the
Honor.
Phrase applies to the community rather than the material?
There are two places in which the phrase as a whole appears in a correctly constructed standard, and you see this in the Illinois statute. One is in the community as a whole in the second prong, but it also says as a whole at the beginning as a preface to the entire three prongs, and that is the innovation that Miller added to Ginsburg. This is laid out fairly well, I think, in the amicus brief supporting us by the various media groups. So if you look at the Illinois video harmful to minors statute, what it says is that, let's see if I can just find this, Your Honor. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to come on it, but basically that you should look at the material as a whole with respect to all three prongs, and then in the second prong there was a second reference to the community as a whole. But I think it's well understood now that you should not just look at one particular snippet for deciding whether it's prurient or whether it's too sexually explicit or what the value is. All of that ought to be assessed by looking at the work as a whole in order to come to the right conclusion. While it's true that the district court focused on the second prong, I think the correct way to look at it is that there's an as-a-whole requirement for the whole test. In this circuit, we have a case that Judge Kennelly pointed to, that's the Cinecom case, which expressly states that in regulating access of minors to sexually explicit material, you can't go beyond the Ginsburg test. And that case has never been questioned or overruled in this circuit. We have instead references by the state to various Supreme Court decisions, but they haven't been able to come up with a single Supreme Court case applying strict scrutiny, which they say applies here, they have to say applies here, upholding a law restricting access of minors beyond the Ginsburg category. The Ginsburg category, of course, is speech that's not protected at all. But there isn't a single case out there applying strict scrutiny saying that you can ignore one of these prongs and we'll go ahead and allow you to ban sales of material in a bookstore or a video store or whatever it may be. Now, we have cases about television, and television is a special problem for a variety of reasons, the most prominent of which, the court has said, is that four-year-olds turn on the television and, you know, there's a real problem of an unwilling viewer there, and so that plus the scarcity problem of the spectrum leading to a much greater regulation of television means that those cases are cases in which strict scrutiny is not applied. And so you can't take anything from those cases and extrapolate from them to uphold a case involving a retail store selling a product which is no different from a book or a magazine or a video. And there's no reason that the state has offered in the district court or has offered today why suddenly we're going to depart from the standards that are well understood that regulate the retail establishment distribution of fully protected speech. The line that has been drawn by the Supreme Court has been drawn by the state of Illinois in its statutes and has apparently worked well with respect to expression in this state and the access of minors thereto for the past generation of time. There isn't an issue out there that anybody has been able to identify suggesting why we need to do something different at this point.
How is a seller more burdened by the 18 requirement than it would be by the requirements that are already imposed by the harmful to minor statute? In other words, the seller already has to determine if the gain falls under the harmful to minor statute, and you don't seem to object to that law. What additional burden do you view being imposed by our statute?
The labeling requirement in particular? The main problem with the labeling requirement, as I see it, is that if the sale and distribution limitation is held unconstitutional, then requiring them to put an 18 on games that they have a constitutional right to sell and games that minors have a constitutional right to buy is deceptive. It essentially says to the buyer, it may say a variety of things as you indicated, but at least it's likely to say to some people that it's illegal for somebody under 18 to buy this game. And if you agree with the district court that it's not illegal, that there's a constitutional right to buy this game, then you can't still make people put an 18 on the game. It is true that the retailers have some obligation to know when their games go beyond the harmful to minors level. Whether there's ever been a game that does that, at least to date, is unclear to me, but it's conceivable we'll get there someday. But certainly you can't make people put an 18 on their product, cover up the front of the label, and imply that it's illegal for 17-year-olds to buy the game if it's not. That's not helping prevent deception of consumers. That would be deceiving consumers. So that's our primary concern about the label, Your Honor.
The bottom line of your argument is that for this panel to rule in favor of the state here, we would absolutely have to overrule the 1973 Cinecom case.
Yes, Your Honor, and certainly that there's been nothing pointed to in the Supreme Court jurisprudence since that would allow you to even begin to say, well, it's been kind of overruled implicitly, even if a panel is allowed to do that sometimes. There's certainly nothing in the Supreme Court case law that would justify that. The only other point that the state makes, and by the time they get to the reply brief, they sort of try to say, well, it's not really a restriction on speech at all. It's just a facilitation of parental authority. But the fact of the matter is this law says this willing seller can't sell this fully protected speech to this willing buyer. That in anybody's book, is a censorship of speech. If you're going to allow the state to say, well, we are censoring speech, we're just facilitating parental authority, then the next thing they're going to do is they're going to say, well, maybe you should have rules that kids can't buy evolution books without their parental authority, or Harry Potter books, or some other books that some parents may find controversial. You clearly can't allow that kind of an exception to the First Amendment for minors.
So are they flat out misrepresenting your arguments when they say that the statute doesn't stop a single adult from buying the games for themselves or for their children?
Your Honor, in some sense they're right, in some sense they're wrong. We do argue that if you put these big 18s on games, that there'll be some adults that will be deterred, and there will be some retailers who won't carry any of these games that adults are allowed to buy. So there will be an effect on adults. At the same time, it is true that an adult with a driver's license that says he's 19 will be able to buy a game if it's actually in the store and he's willing to take a game up to the counter that has a big 18 plastered on the top of it. In some sense, that concession is true, but it doesn't have any legal consequence because we're talking here not just about the rights of adults, but the rights of minors themselves, who under the First Amendment have First Amendment rights, and the Supreme Court has told us where those rights end, and they end at the Ginsburg standard.
If you left the 18 on, it might increase sales. Did you ever think of that?
Your Honor, it may increase them in some cases, but it certainly the retailers ought to have a right to decide, and the manufacturers how to label their own products in a non-deceptive way. What this 18 will do is it'll cover up everything they've already put in the labeling, including the voluntary material that the labeling that the industry does. So it's a kind of a sledgehammer approach to labeling, which is not only deceptive but is unreasonable in terms of what you would make people put on a package this size, a 2x2 label with a big 18 on it on the front. You know, that can't be a legitimate way to regulate commercial speech.
Getting back to that, the argument that they're making, you know, that it really is very similar, the sale of video games and TV programs, mm-hmm. correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand it, a lot of the sexual content of the video games is deeply hidden in code.
Well, there was this one instance, Your Honor, where it was hidden, where it wasn't really part of the game in the sense that you had to be a hacker to find that it was hidden in the code, and then you had to have a patch that you download. And how that happened is a matter of some controversy, but it was an interesting example of how the industry system works, because they had rated that game M, mature, for primarily for violence. They didn't know about that scene at the ratings board. When this came out, they changed the rating to adults only, which meant, in fact, that it couldn't be sold in most of the retailers in the United States. It was pulled off the shelves because Walmart and those places don't sell adults only games. So then they had to basically reissue it without that sort of hidden thing in there, and then it went back to M, and it started being sold again. So that was actually an example of the industry self-regulation working pretty well. There is a limit on how far sexually explicit material can go under the industry standards, because these retailers simply won't sell what amounts to an X-rated video game. They don't go. They just don't do that as a matter of policy. If there aren't further questions on this issue, I guess I could turn to the 11th Amendment issue next sense, Your Honor. Our argument on that issue, as I think the court has already noted, is that there isn't any case out there suggesting that the Attorney General lacks a sufficient connection to the enforcement of criminal statutes to be sued in a facial attack on a criminal statute of this kind. The Sherman case, which is the case that the Attorney General relied on almost exclusively in her brief, and in fact the briefs characterized it as involving a criminal statute, is just not. It is not a criminal statute. It's actually in the education code. It's the telling school districts what kind of curriculum they have to have. The very next provision in the statute, if you look at it, is about how many hours of physical education they have to provide in the school districts. You know, so it's not a criminal statute at all. And if you look at it as a question of first principle, the idea that there isn't a sufficient connection between the Illinois Attorney General and the enforcement of criminal laws seems to us to be insupportable. The Attorney General has the authority to come in and prosecute crimes in the trial court, and has the authority to come in and assist the state's attorney in prosecutions in trial court, as well as the exclusive authority up when the case gets up to the Illinois Supreme Court. And that would seem to us to go far beyond anything that Ex parte Young requires. What you see in the Illinois Attorney General's brief is kind of a creation of new standards designed, I think, to meet the problem they face, which is to say, well, it has to be the person with primary authority. It can't be concurrent authority. It has to be exclusive authority. But there isn't any such requirement in the law. All there has to be is some connection between that person, a sufficient connection, and certainly the fact that the Attorney General litigates criminal cases all the time would seem to us to be a sufficient basis. And, you know, you think about what the alternative would be here. We have a First Amendment violation, a law that on its face regulates fully protected speech subject to strict scrutiny. You have an absolute need to get this adjudicated before the law takes effect. You want to get it adjudicated statewide. The idea that we would have to do a defendant class action against all of the 102 state's attorneys in this state and serve them all and get them all to come into this to a district court somewhere and have to do that to bring a facial challenge to a statute is certainly not something that the court ought to be too aggressive in trying to bring about. That's just a crazy way. I mean, what would happen if you did that, I assume, is that a responsible Attorney General of Illinois would intervene to defend the state law, and you'd end up where you should have started in the first place. I can't imagine that they're going to want to let 102 state's attorneys file briefs defending the facially validity of a state law. But maybe that could happen, I suppose. So it seems to us there's neither a legal reason nor a practical reason why you should prevent people in the same position that we were in from suing the Attorney General in the future if such a law is passed. If there are no further questions, I appreciate your time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be as brief as I can. I realize I'm short on time. Regarding this notion of the industry self-policing, Grand Theft Auto sold 5.1 million copies in the first 7 weeks of its availability before this patch was discovered. That seems to me to be closing the the barn door after the horse has been stolen. Regarding the Cinecom decision, that was a nudity in the drive-in case. And that case, the Erzosnik case, dealt with that at the Supreme Court level and talked about how the absence of eroticism is what doomed that statute. So we don't think it's necessary to overturn that decision in order to uphold this statute. And finally, regarding the three prongs, Mr. Smith talked about how the third prong isn't necessary when it comes to television. So,
well, tell me this. Would we have to overrule American Amusement?
No, certainly not. That did not have anything to do with sexual expression at all. Mr. Smith talked about how the third prong analysis isn't required in television. Well, so that indicates that the absence of the third prong isn't the end of the analysis, it's the beginning. And the interest the state is trying to uphold here is to protect children from the exposure to sexually explicit material. Now, it hurts just as much if you get kicked in the head by accident or on purpose. And we're trying to protect children from being kicked in the head, not just from accidental kicks in the head. The interest that the state has in protecting children from the harm they get from being exposed to this material, not just the accidental exposure that may come from television. In every other medium that this court has talked about, television, indeed, cable television, where they talk about blocking technology, telephones, in the U.S. mail, as mentioned in our brief in the Rowan case, in all of these cases, the court has adopted and promoted systems that give parents the right to make decisions about what sexually explicit material their children view. And that's all that this statute does. And for that reason, we believe it's constitutional. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Fineman.
Very quickly, we don't rely on Sherman exclusively. We rely on the certain principles set forth in Sherman, also rely on the Southern Pacific case from the Ninth Circuit, Shell Oil case from the First Circuit. In our reply brief, we did acknowledge that the statute in Sherman was not a criminal statute. The Attorney General's powers to enforce ordinary criminal statutes does not rise to the level of what the Minnesota Attorney General's powers were in Young. As the Supreme Court recognized in Young, the Minnesota Attorney General had full general discretion to enforce the statute in question. There were no statutory restrictions on what the Attorney General could do. And here in Illinois, as we explained in our brief, the Attorney General is somewhat limited as to what she could do in the state trial court if the relevant state's attorney objects. In other words, in Young, the Attorney General's power was plenary.
As a matter of fact, he doesn't have to object. He has to invite him in.
Yes. Although Massarella suggests, People versus Massarella suggests that
if he's not doing his duty, that they can come in independently. But that's a separate problem altogether.
Right. In terms of this, Mr. Smith says that there's no principle suggesting that if the Attorney General's power is contingent, she can't be named. That's exactly what the court. The situation facing the Ninth Circuit in Southern Pacific, there the court held that the Attorney General of Oregon was not an appropriate defendant in a case, even though there was Oregon law cited by the Ninth Circuit saying that the Attorney General could prosecute a case if the governor directed the Attorney General to do so. So there you have another contingent situation where the Attorney General could prosecute a statute but was not the frontline prosecutor.
On the Sherman case, it's good that you acknowledged that that was not a criminal case, but you did say in your opening brief that this case is controlled by Sherman. You still stick by that statement.
Sherman is not dispositive, but there are principles set forth in Sherman. First, that the state's attorneys are the public prosecutors in Illinois, and second, that is not permissible under the 11th Amendment or Young to name the Attorney General in an effort to bind the state as a whole.
So you make a distinction between dispositive and controlling.
I wouldn't say it's controlling. I'd say that those two principles in Sherman are very instructive in terms of how to resolve this case. Thank you. Thank you for the additional time.
Thank you. Thank you, one and all. The case will be taken under advisement. All right.